thoughtfully before stabbing out like spears. Rank for rank, the only person who could match Rufus's skill on the battlefield was possibly Danielle Geller. Rufus's enemies certainly couldn't, but they were not rank for rank. Now the enemy had given up on hiding its true form, its speed and strength were backed up by powerful abilities and its uncanny metal arms. Rufus's skill allowed him to barely hold on in the face of a suddenly more powerful enemy, but every moment was a desperate scramble to stay alive. It was a clash of unsurpassed skill and overwhelming power. Perfectly executed attacks met defenses that were no more than adequate, but so powerful that they were up to the task, regardless. What little damage Rufus managed to inflict was quickly guarded by a conjured metal shield. It only occupied one arm, leaving three to attack. The enemy's other abilities could rapidly repair the grafted armor, or even heal when Rufus's blade dug into flesh. Like most humans, many of Rufus's abilities were special attacks. He used all his skills to maximize their effectiveness, every trick he had. Feinting to land an attack on a blind spot, moving to expose a weakness. The unprecedented threat drew out every scrap of capability. If their advancement as essence users were closer, the bizarre foe would have been utterly outclassed. But this was not the case. There was no escaping the tyranny of rank. As Rufus chained each attack into the next, the enemy was counter-attacking. Its essence powers allowed it to transmute the arms into other forms, allowing for its own special attacks. It began by changing them into lance-like weapons for simple but powerful attacks. Rufus was able to predict the linear attacks and effectively dodge. It changed to ball and chain weapons, but Rufus likewise anticipated their movement. Their weakness was the recovery time after attacks, which Rufus baited out before ducking out of range, then came back to counter. The enemy changed tack again, moving back itself when Rufus was pulling away. Its arms became needle launchers, spitting streams of tiny but deadly needles at him and forcing him to close in again. As he did, the arms became razor whips that slashed about wildly. They weren't as powerful as the ball and chain weapons, but were relentless and unpredictable. Every moment of the battle, Rufus was running on a knife edge. Even glancing blows from his more powerful enemy meant serious damage, and he was being ravaged by the increasingly tricky attacks. He was forced to stay close, or even more needles would pincushion him, but that left him open to the lacerating whips, now dripping with his blood. It was the ground under his feet that finally betrayed him. The rainforest of the astral space was full of wet earth, churned into mud by first the expedition camp and then the battle. Rufus slipped, just slightly, but he had been fighting with no margin of error. A metal arm transformed into a blade and slashed upwards, severing Rufus's sword arm. Stumbling in shock, Rufus was done. Another kick launched him away like Gary, but even in that state, his training-honed instincts kicked in. He threw himself to cushion the blow, which saved his life, but only barely. Crippled and near dead, he was sent tumbling helplessly through the mud. Chapter 110. Help arrives. Emir and his people had already left the city by the time Jason and the others arrived. They were traveling over the desert on sand skimmers, although the desert was more rocks than sand. Once they reached the aperture to the astral space, they could use tracking stones to find the group quickly. They had every tracking stone from every member of the expedition packed into a dimensional bag. It would take time to cross the desert and reach the aperture to the astral space, but Emir had a trump card. One of his people specialized in magical tools and could periodically push their skimmers to speeds well beyond their normal capability. The whole vehicle vibrated under him as it raced at a pace it was never designed for, but Emir was unfazed. All that concerned him was arriving in time. Not every adventurer had managed to join up with the main formation as it withdrew. Whole teams had been cut off from the main force, isolated individuals falling quickly. Those that managed to remain in groups fared better, but most paid a price in blood for their escape. Humphrey was with Phoebe Geller, her brother Rick, and his team. They were fighting their way out through a hell of magical automatons, stained red with the blood of adventurers. Beset from all sides, Humphrey's huge sword carved the team a path. The big man, Jonah, bore the brunt of the enemy's attacks at the rear. Phoebe and Rick held the flanks, completing the cordon around the twin elf sisters. Just as it seemed like they were making progress, a new wave of construct monsters appeared and moved in. While Rufus and Gary were tied up with the silver rancor, Farah had been fending off every other enemy. Without their support, she was being pushed to the edge. Barely holding on against the encroaching horde, there was now nothing between her and the abomination. On top of everything else, she was running low on mana. Dealing with the press of enemies had left her exhausted at the worst possible time. She was reduced to relying on her heavy armor and sword whip, neither of which were a match for the abomination now bearing down on her. The retreating forces reeled from the impact of the enemy leadership entering the fray. They had leapt from the strange constructs they rode as mounts and moved forwards to attack the defensive line. Danielle rushed around barking orders, personally intervening as needed. The line buckled in places, but was yet to breach. Spotting one of the silver rank leaders, Danielle drove into the melee personally. She fought with a weapon conjured from her dimension essence called a dimensional blade. It looked like a sword made of black lightning lined in silver. It hissed and sizzled, the blade wild and flickering. There was no weight to it, but it could cut through almost anything and cause destructive harm to whatever it touched. Quicker than lightning, she launched a sneak attack, putting the robed figure onto the back foot. The enemy reacted by bursting out of its robes to reveal a hideously monstrous form. The bulk of the construct army were similar to magical combat dummies, segmented section of limbs, head, and torso, threaded onto a skeletal metal frame. Casting aside its robe, the enemy was revealed to be similar to such a dummy, but with a horrifying difference. Instead of limbs of wood or stone, each wholly separate segment, hands, feet, arms, legs, head, were all made of living flesh. Like a dummy, the limbs were carried on a human-like skeleton of steel rather than bone. Danielle only paused for a moment at the disgusting visage before resuming her attack. They couldn't take the skimmers through the aperture, so once they arrived in the astral space, Emir and his people were on foot. Not all had the movement abilities to keep pace with Emir, but he didn't wait. Only two of his people, specialized in mobility, were able to keep up as they dashed in the direction the tracking stones were pointing them. They quickly discovered they were on some kind of island chain, but the water didn't slow them down. On the contrary, they moved faster over the calm water than the crowded terrain of the tropical islands. Danielle drove the freakish enemy into retreat, but she chose not to follow. The fight had drawn her attention from the larger battle, and she needed to stop and reassess. Leaping high in the air, she used one of her time powers to slow herself down, floating as she scanned the battlefield. She looked for potential weak points in their formation and people she could send to reinforce them. On a distant flank, she spotted a second bizarre silver rancor overwhelming Rufus. It was another disgusting fusion of metal and flesh, half-construct creature and half-living being. Even as she turned her full attention to the action, Rufus slipped and the fight was over. His arm was severed and his opponent kicked him away. Seeing the abomination turn to Farah, Danielle teleported directly into the fray. In the chaos of battle, Thadwick and his two offsiders, Neil and Dustin, had been separated from the main force. Dustin had used his powers to protect them, while Neil had kept them alive with his healing. Thadwick had been blasting powers blindly into the enemy at range, exhausting his mana. "Replenish me!" Thadwick demanded. "You can't just keep throwing attacks into the pack," Neil said. "We have to find a way to rejoin the group, not draw more enemy attention." Thadwick's essences were lightning, wind, potent, and storm, and he had used a preponderance of awakening stones of the Magus to get more spells than the human affinity for special attacks would normally produce. His essence powers were all simple, straightforwards, and powerful, with an attendant high mana cost. What they were not was subtle. Thadwick looked around, only now realizing how isolated they were, in spite of warnings the others had given him. "You need to hold them off, so I can get back," he told the other two, immediately running away from the enemy. Neil and Dustin looked at each other. Dusty? Did he just...
Yeah, he did.
I am so done with that little turd. Danielle had seen Jason fighting in her Mirage Arena enough to envy the freedom with which he teleported. Even after years using her own ability, there was still a moment of disorientation on arrival. That moment proved to be everything, as she arrived close to Farah and the monstrous Silver Ranker attacking her. That fleeting confusion was all too costly, as four metal arms pierced into Farah's body like spears. Neither Farah's blade nor her armor was enough to block them, one of which buried itself in her head. Farah's corpse was still falling to the ground as Danielle recovered and attacked. The four arms were fast, but like her enemy, Danielle was at the peak of Silver Rank. Her confluence essence was time, and everything seemed to slow around her as her dimensional blade cut into her enemy again and again. It was, in many ways, a reflection of Rufus's fight. She was more skilled than her enemy and used expert technique to strike out with her conjured blade. She even had a power, similar to the one Rufus possessed, to briefly accelerate so fast that the world around her seemed frozen. The difference between her fight and Rufus's was that she was not overpowered by the enemy. Instead of bouncing off seemingly impervious metal, her weapon left savage gouges in steel and flesh both. She did not have to compensate for lesser strength and speed, instead easily outpaced her enemy. When she was struck, the injuries were much less dangerous to her Silver Rank armor and toughness. Suddenly she seemed to make a mistake, overextending as she lunged for her opponent's main body and leaving an opening for all four arms to lance into her body. It did not miss the brief but crucial chance, metal limbs piercing through her armor. Unexpectedly, they stopped dead as they hit her flesh, like they had struck an impervious wall. The enemy realized it had been baited, even as she placed her hand on its chest. The wounds that it should have inflicted on her were instead unleashed on its own body by her power. Heavily injured, the Silver Ranker scrambled to escape. Danielle wanted to give chase, but in the absence of Farah, enemies were encroaching. No Silver Ranker would go down easy, and she didn't have time to press the fight. She reluctantly allowed it to flee. She moved to hold the line, calling for more people to assist. Once things had stabilized, she took stock. Gary was on his feet again, but barely, staggering forwards with a face full of fury. Danielle picked up Rufus's severed arm and pushed it into his chest. "Rufus needs you now," she said firmly. "Farah is past help." Gary's face crumbled in agony, and for a moment it looked like he would try and shove past her, but instead he nodded and turned to Rufus. Rufus was still on the ground, disoriented and in shock. His eyes darted back and forth unfocused, his face confused. Still holding the severed arm, Gary dismissed his conjured armor, picked Rufus up, and headed for the back lines. He tried to yell for a healer, but it came as a loud croak, his own torso having been savagely pummeled. People were coming in to hold the line, and the enemy leadership was pulling back. Whether from an unwillingness to lose all their constructs, or from almost losing part of their leadership, it was enough that they started withdrawing from the engagement. Danielle retrieved Farah's body, whose conjured armor had vanished on her death. Under the feet of swarming constructs, it had been mangled unrecognizably. She sealed it away in an Adventure Society casket, which she then placed into her storage space. Danielle wasn't happy with their position, with the water at their back. Organization was still a mess, certainly beyond crossing between islands under battle conditions. The advantage was that the beach was an open enough space to regroup and take stock. The only other open area was the cleared ground of the camp, which they had paid such a price to escape from. They had lost another Silver Ranker, and some of the bronze, but most of those left were solid. The major loss was Farah. Not only had she been a massive factor in the large-scale combat, but her companions were almost as valuable, and her loss had gutted their morale. The group still had their Silver Rank healer, so reattaching Rufus's arm hadn't been a problem. The brutal kick that had sent him out of combat had required more healing. Aside from the tiredness that came with the extensive healing, Rufus and Gary were physically good as new, Emotionally, they were wrecked, especially Rufus. Left sitting in the sand with the other recovering adventurers, he just stared into space, saying nothing. Gary paced back and forth next to him, a volcano that could erupt at any moment. The eruption, however, came from elsewhere. Thalia Mercer, who Danielle needed calm and collected, was exploding on a pair of iron rankers.
You left him out there alone?
We didn't leave anyone, Neil said, standing up to Thalia's fury. Your son told us to hold them back while he was already running for it. It's not our fault you're... Thadwick's other lackey thumped Neil on the arm to shut him up. Venting a decade of frustration at that moment would likely get them both killed by Thadwick's furious mother. It looked like it might happen anyway, until Danielle arrived, placing herself between Thalia and the pair.
We need to go find him,
Thalia told Danielle, the other pair vanishing from her consideration. Thalia regained some composure as she looked at her friend's face.
I'm sorry, Danielle said, but we're still taking stock. People who were isolated are still drifting in. He may well, too. Sending more people out before we have headcounts is borrowing trouble when we already have a surplus.
He's my son. If it were Humphrey still missing, would you be sending people out?
Humphrey is still missing, Danielle said, her face as hard as granite.
Oh,
Thalia said helplessly, after a lengthy pause.
Did Cassandra come through all right?
She's taking a head count of the family right now.
I'm glad. I need your best right now, Thalia. Or at least, you're good enough, which is still better than most people's best.
Thalia nodded.
Good. Now let's start getting things under control.
Humphrey eventually turned up, accompanied by the brother-sister pairing of Rick and Phoebe Geller. The survivors of Rick's team were with them, having lost two of their number. Henry Geller, their flame-wielding damage dealer, had died. Their big frontliner, Jonah, had held back the enemy to let the others escape, his ultimate fate unknown. Amir and his people finally arrived. They were too late to intervene in the battle, but were a boost to the makeshift camp's crippled morale. Once word passed that a gold ranker had arrived to assist, hope was re-sparked in hearts full of fear. He was alone enough to prevent a repeat of the battle they had just escaped, and there were more silver rankers on the way. Amir met with Danielle, getting a rundown of events. There were still people unaccounted for, but the tracking stones in Amir's possession allowed them to sort the missing from the dead. They organized teams to retrieve the living, with every recovery team having a silver ranker for safety. With the initial organization done, Amir sought out Rufus, Gary watching over him. Rufus's blank eyes took a moment to register Amir's presence.
I failed her,
Rufus said, his voice barely audible.
No,
Amir said, softly, moving to place a hand on his shoulder.
She died as well as any of us could ask. Comrades behind her, enemies in front of her, and friends beside her.
Chapter 111 Strange Star. Most of the ill-fated expedition was extracted back through the aperture that had been their entry point. On the other side was a recovery camp, ready and waiting. Only silver rankers and bronze rankers stayed in the astral space, and not all of them. Every member of the new streamlined expedition had either arrived with Amir or been hand-picked by Danielle and Thalia. They drew back to the island and had their underwater aperture just offshore, using it as a staging point. As preparations were made to track down their missing people, a steady stream of departing expedition members waded into the water and through the aperture just below the surface. The tricky part was managing the people still unconscious after being healed from extreme injury. The adventurers with water powers were employed to see them through. With the withdrawal from the astral space organized, the next priority was to retrieve the adventurers who had become separated from the group. Teams led by silver rankers set out, using tracking stones to find them. Only once that was done would they turn to finding and destroying the enemy. With only the cream of the expedition remaining, bolstered by Emir's people, Danielle was confident of eradicating the construct army and its masters. Her greatest concern was actually finding them. The follow-up attack she had been fearful of never arrived, and the search teams hadn't run into anyone but missing expedition members.
"There's a problem," Emir said. He was in the command tent with Danielle and Thalia.
"You'll have to narrow that down," Danielle said, without humor.
"We still have 19 missing people that are still alive, according to their tracking stones," Emir said. "The problem is that for 5 of them, their stone indicates they're still alive, but can't track them."
"Could they have lost their badges, or had them taken?" Thalia asked.
"If they lost them, we'd still be able to track the badges. The best explanation we can hope for is that the astral space has regions that naturally mask tracking. I've seen it in astral spaces before, although they were all less stable than this one."
"Not unheard of," Danielle said.
"It could be racial gift evolution," Thalia said. "Our lost people certainly have the right conditions to trigger it."
"We know ability evolutions change an ability to make immediate needs," Thalia said. "An ability that prevents them from being tracked would make sense."
"But 5 people, all getting skill evolutions at once, and all the same or similar abilities?" Danielle asked. "It would be great if that's what's happened, and they're all fine, but we can't anticipate that being the case."
"The alternatives get worse from there," Emir said. "Something may have happened to them that changed their aura so much that they no longer match the aura imprint on their badges, which would break the tracking magic, which would suggest the enemy found them and did something to them."
"Who are the 5? Danielle asked.
Emir looked at Thalia with sympathy.
"I'm sorry, but they include Jonah Geller and Thadwick Mercer."
Thalia's face twisted, but she kept herself under control.
"What are we going to do about it?" she asked.
"Once we have the ones we can track," Danielle said, "we need to sweep this whole place anyway. The goal is still to find out what is happening to the astral space and stop it. If our people are still out there to find, we'll find them."
"And how long will that take?" Thalia asked.
"We've surveyed enough to know the astral space is only a fraction of the size of the world it's attached to," Danielle said. "We don't leave until we retrieve all our people, living or dead."
"Quite right," Emir said. "And as it happens, my people are specialists at finding things over large areas that are often hidden with magic. Hope is by no means an outlandish choice."
Thalia nodded.
"I want to hear as soon as we find anything."
"Of course."
The support camp outside the aperture was an array of large tents set up near the opening. The aperture was in a crevice in a rocky outcropping, and people were coming out in a steady stream. On the astral space side, the healers were in triage mode, healing people up just enough to send them through the underwater aperture. The soaking wet adventurers were then sorted into 2 groups. Those in need of further healing were taken to the recovery tents, while the rest were sent to the dormitory tents. Vincent was in charge of the camp and had roped Jason in as his assistant. There wasn't much call for Jason's cleansing ability, just the occasional infection. Vincent was in charge of making the actual decisions, with Jason's job being to sort out any problems with enacting them. Jason's biggest responsibility was dealing with people who weren't happy with the arrangements and keeping them from bothering Vincent. It was, Vincent claimed, the entire reason he chose Jason to assist him. Even after escaping the horrors of battle, there were some who felt the need to complain about the accommodations. These were the ones who never saw the front line and were evacuated first.
"You expect me to stay in a tent with all these people?"
a nobleman asked Jason.
"You were in a tent during the expedition," Jason said.
"A private magical tent,"
This is just a tarp with poles, and as for what you generously describe as beds... Listen, mate, you've got three options. Option one is taking the accommodation and shutting your damn mouth. Option two is you sod off into the desert and find your own way home. Option three is you hang about making a nuisance of yourself and your mouth gets shut for you.
You think you can treat me like this? You have no idea who you're...
Fellas! Jason called out loudly, over the top of the nobleman. We've got another option three! A pair of adventurers came into the tent, their bronze rank auras visibly impacting the nobleman, who they led away. After a very thorough talking to, he would be placed with the other troublemakers in an isolated group of tents with people watching over them. Rufus and Gary were sent back with the other bronze rankers Danielle deemed unreliable. Gary gave a brief explanation of Farah's absence before Jason sent the pair to the healers for further treatment. Afterwards, Jason was sleepwalking through his duties in a daze until Vincent had someone take his place. Suddenly free, Jason went looking for Gary and Rufus. He found them in the dormitory tents, sent there after their healing was completed. Rufus sat on a cot bunk, staring blankly into nowhere. He wasn't alone. Everyone in that tent had lost friends or family. It was a cluster of misery and shock. Jason sat next to Rufus, not saying a word, as Gary told the story in detail. Afterward, the three sat in silence for a long time, other adventurers bustling around them. Finally, Jason stood up, patted Rufus on the shoulder, and went back to work. Emir and his people quickly rounded up the scattered adventurers. Even the five who couldn't be tracked were recovered in short order, found so badly injured that their auras barely registered to even silver rank sensors. The search team stumbled across all five while tracking the others. Emir watched Thalia fussing over Thadwick. He was still unconscious after being healed, and she was arranging Cassandra to take him back through the portal. Walking back into the command tent, Danielle was already present. There was a troubled frown on her face.
"Something the matter?" Emir asked. "Beyond the obvious, I mean."
"It was too easy," Danielle said. "Our search teams found all five without even looking. That makes the back of my neck itch."
"You think they were left for us?"
"How often does an adventurer's aura shift so much their tracker doesn't work?"
"I don't know," Emir said. "I've heard of it happening after intense trauma, and you saw the condition they were in."
"Have you seen it before?"
"No."
"You haven't seen it once, and we have five at the same time."
"It does sound suspicious when you say it out loud. We can have the Magic Society examine them."
"It won't be that easy," Danielle said. "Their families will resist. If something has been done to them, their families will want to quietly handle it. Letting the Magic Society look into it takes control out of their hands."
"That's incredibly short-sighted."
"Welcome to the politics of Greenstone."
"What about the one from your family?"
"Once we return to Greenstone, I'll use a speaking chamber to talk to his parents. They should have no priority beyond what's best for their son. The problem is the director of Greenstone's Magic Society branch. He'll definitely come down on the side of the families, to the point of refusing to have any of them examined."
"That's not good."
"No," Danielle said. "We may have to have Jonah examined ourselves and go from there."
"I have trouble believing people would choose ignorance. I would have thought they would want to know if something had been done to their family members. Perhaps we can convince them of that."
"Have you not met people?" Danielle asked. "We love choosing ignorance. This is not the time to start a fight over it. Right now, everyone has lost people. It won't pay to poke at raw wounds."
"Then the best we can do for now is keep an eye on them. In the meantime, we have more work to do."
Danielle nodded. Their original task was to investigate what was going wrong with the astral space, What they had found inside made finding the truth all the more important. She had tasked Emir with fetching back the scattered adventurers while she reorganized the expedition. The group was pared down to its best and reinforced by Emir's people, all of whom were not only capable, but experienced in exploring unusual environments. With the missing adventurers retrieved, there were now teams thoroughly sweeping the islands. They found regular traces of the enemy's activities, bringing back various magical paraphernalia from abandoned worksites. It was quickly becoming evident that their enemy had been occupying the astral space for months, if not years. After the battle with the expedition, however, all signs pointed to a rapid withdrawal. Every site they found showed signs of immediate evacuation.
"Thank you for this," Cassandra said, squeezing Jason's hand. He had organized a separate tent for the five adventurers whose tracking had failed. They were all restored to health, but would not wake for some time.
"The least I can do," he said, giving her a tired smile. "Not the reunion I was expecting."
"I need to get back," Cassandra told him. "There's still work to do."
He nodded, looking around the bustling camp. There were over 100 people now, many of whom seemed to feel like they should be in charge of it. His early stopgap measures were being overrun by sheer numbers, and he could no longer shield Vincent from the pressure.
"There's work enough here, too."
"I heard about your friend," she told him. "I didn't know her well, but I'm sorry. Are you doing all right?"
"No, but are any of us? We all lost friends.
I'll see you again when this is all done."
The edges of the astral space were marked by a rainbow-colored void of chaotic energy, radiating a powerful aura that gave even Emir pause. The astral space, while certainly vast, turned out to be only a fraction of the size of the desert. Even so, there were hundreds of islands, of which the teams could thoroughly search around a dozen each day. The enemy had fled, leaving most of their constructed army to harry pursuing forces. There were also ordinary monsters to contend with, but neither posed a real threat to the powerful search teams. The enemy leadership themselves fled through various apertures. The teams followed them through, usually finding they had caused chaos on the other side before vanishing into various areas of the desert. Not all managed to escape, however, and the teams managed to capture two of the enemy leaders. Like the others they had seen, under the robes they were horrifying fusions of steel and flesh. The two leaders gave up no information, suiciding in explosive fashion on being caught. Emir increased his personal participation in the search, hoping his gold rank power would let him take someone alive. He approached an enemy camp alone, his aura restrained as his senses spread out. It had been a major encampment once, with cleared land and wooden huts. Now it was mostly deserted. Emir sensed only one living aura and a plethora of constructs. Emir closed in on the camp through the thick forest, finally close enough to take a look. He saw the one robed figure packing tools into a dimensional bag, surrounded by artificial guardians. Watching from hiding, Emir held an open suppression collar in one hand and a conjured staff in the other. The staff had a black stone shaft, with golden script running down it and golden caps at each end. He slammed the base of the staff into the ground, and copies of it erupted from the ground under every construct creature. The iron-ranked constructs exploded into chunks at the sheer force, the bronze likewise destroyed at a blow. The silvers survived, but were tossed into the air. Emir was already moving. He vanished from the spot, leaving an illusory afterimage behind as he appeared next to the startled human. Emir had already dropped the staff and used both hands to snap the suppression collar around the human's neck. Emir's concern was that suppression collars took a few moments to adapt to the wearer and suppress their powers. The human's hands shot up to pull the collar off, but Emir slapped his hands away. Emir could sense the effect on the enemy's aura as the man's powers were suppressed. The enemy sneered at Emir, lunging towards him, as Emir sensed a silver rank power suddenly rising up inside the man. It wasn't the man's own power, but something inside him. Emir retreated in an instant, leaving another afterimage in his place. Huge crystalline spikes erupted from the man in every direction, greater in volume than the man's own body. They ripped him to shreds from the inside, leaving a bloody carcass draped over a strange star of jagged crystal. A half dozen damaged silver-ranked constructs fell out of the air. Emir moved in a blur as he conjured his staff again and smashed them apart before moving to examine the dead man and the bloody sculpture that had emerged from him. He could sense the magic had faded, leaving an inert object for him to examine.
"That's not something you just come across on the street,"
he muttered to himself as he looked it over. As he did so, he was joined by Constance, his chief of staff.
"This is what happened with the other two," she told him.
"It wasn't his power," Emir said. "It was some kind of object inside him. If we manage to catch up to another one, we'll need some way to negate it."
Chapter 112. The Accumulation of a Life. While the search for answers continued in the astral space, the support camp was suddenly swarmed with bronze rankers Danielle and Thalia deemed insufficiently reliable to participate. There was also a pair of silver rankers, one of whom was named Gloria Fail. She had no interest in running the camp, but didn't want a commoner in a position of authority, so she rallied the bronze rankers, ousted Vincent, and installed her son in his place. The administrative skills of the new camp leader left something to be desired, and since Jason had stayed on as his assistant, he did his best to keep things running smoothly. This quickly proved infeasible, as the new camp leader had little interest in doing or even hearing about things. This was remedied by having Jason removed as well. Left idle, Jason spent his time with Gary and Rufus, who were still barely moving. He would robotically eat a spirit coin when prompted by Gary, but never talked. Gary took Jason aside because they were running out of coins and needed clean clothes. Their possessions had all been stored in Farah's storage space. Jason went and found Vincent.
"That worthless wet sack of nothing actually had me confined to the tent," Vincent complained.
"Are they enforcing that?" Jason asked.
"No, but it's still humiliating."
"That doesn't matter," Jason said. "Gary and I need to do something, so we need you to keep an eye on Rufus." Vincent had been giving Rufus his distance at Gary's suggestion.
"Of course," Vincent said. He and Gary went out into the desert. They found a flat space of red, rocky earth, far from the prying eyes of the camp, and Jason took out the casket containing Farah's body. He had been keeping it in his own storage space since she was brought out through the aperture. She was in a magical casket that would preserve her until she was returned to her family. Jason once had the somber task of placing another adventurer in an identical casket, and now understood why friends and family were not the ones sent to recover a fallen adventurer. Jason started laying out a ritual circle with salt, with Farah's casket at the center. Using the powdered cores of lesser monsters, he tested the circle, correcting it again and again.
"I keep messing it up," he said, voice catching.
"Take your time," Gary told him.
It went unspoken that Jason could have extracted the items from Farah's storage space by looting her body like a monster. They both knew it could be done, but neither man suggested such a defilement. Still trying to get the circle right, Jason had to stop. His vision was swimming with tears as he remembered Farah instructing him on his very first magic circle.
"I was just thinking about when we summoned my familiar," he said. "Remember how we snuck off to the other side of the manor, so Anissa wouldn't find us?"
Gary laughed, reminiscent mirth weighed down with sadness. After days of somber reflection, the sound was strange and alien.
"You wouldn't tell us what it was, but we knew she wouldn't like it, coming from an apocalypse stone."
Farrah walked me through the ritual circle. It was a complex one, for my first time.
You passed out again. You were constantly falling unconscious back then.
Getting hit in the head with a shovel will do that. I sometimes wonder if I don't have some lingering damage from all that cranial trauma.
We've wondered that too, Gary said,
and they shared a sad smile. Jason finished the circle and performed the ritual by reciting an incantation. Items from Farrah's dimensional space started appearing around her casket. By the time it was done, there was a small hill of crates, boxes, bookshelves, cupboards, wardrobes, furniture, and various loose items.
I don't have room for all this in my inventory, Jason said. Some of it won't fit at all. She had a banquet table in there?
How big an item can you fit? Gary asked.
About the size of a regular dining table? Maybe half the size of that great long thing. Who needs a banquet table on hand?
You'd be surprised, Gary said. It doesn't matter if you can't fit everything. There are dimensional bags in here somewhere. The banquet table should fit into a bronze rank one.
They started sorting through everything. The accumulation of a life. They found the dimensional bags, placing Gary's things in one and Rufus's in another. That was only a portion of the pile. The rest they started putting in the remaining bags. Jason brushed his hand along the spines of books on one of the several bookcases. She always wanted me to pay more attention to magical theory, he said.
Take them, Gary said. She'd want you to have them.
You sure?
Just make sure you read them, he instructed Jason. You have no idea how often she complained that you wouldn't learn magic properly. She saw so much potential in you.
I don't know about that, Jason said. But I'll try to live up to it.
Returning to the support camp, Jason and Gary headed for the large dormitory tent where they had left Rufus. As they drew closer, they heard a commotion coming from the tent and saw people evacuating it.
My son almost died because you couldn't hold the line!
Gary and Jason went into the tent. Rufus was standing, his expressionless gaze on a man who had clutched the front of Rufus's clothes in a fist. He was yelling invective at Rufus, blasting out his bronze rank aura. Everyone else had either backed off or left entirely.
What good were you?
The man continued to shout in Rufus's face.
You couldn't even protect yourselves!
I do not like where this is going, Gary said, stepping forwards. Still nothing to say, the man kept yelling. That worthless friend of yours wasn't worth the dirt her blood stained.
Rufus's expression remained blank, but a golden sword appeared in the hand at his side. Gary's hand was faster and stronger, clamping down on Rufus's arm and holding it in place. Gary's other hand formed a fist, which crashed into the face of the yelling man without Gary so much as looking at him. His gaze was on Rufus, who looked back at him blankly.
You dare?
The man asked disbelievingly from the floor. Gary turned to face him.
Leave, otherwise I will let him kill you. He wouldn't dare. Look at him and say that again, Gary said,
stepping aside while keeping a solid grip on Rufus's arm. Rufus looked down at the man, and the man looked back. What he saw in Rufus's empty eyes unnerved him more than the sword in Rufus's hand, and he scrambled away out of the tent. After a brief discussion, Gary and Jason decided that the camp was no good for Rufus. Vincent wanted to stay behind and try and help the camp, futile as his efforts may be. Jason had supplied himself for the desert, and they set out from the camp in the early hours, shortly before sunrise. Their destination was Boko, where Jason had first arrived via Hester's portal. The support camp was in the middle of nowhere, but Jason had the city on his map, and there was no danger of getting lost. It would be a trek of days without a sand skimmer, but that was largely the point. Nothing but quiet, empty space. Rufus followed along passively as they walked. It was reminiscent of their journey through the desert when they first met. After hours of walking in silence, Jason started talking about their first encounter, trapped with Rufus, Gary, and Farah in that basement, then the sacrifice chamber, the terrifying spectacle of Farah's volcano powers. After the tale had run its course, Gary started telling stories from before Jason had met the trio. He told about how they met while fighting a zombie plague that had wiped out a massive town. He talked of other adventures they had undertaken together. He spoke of how they champed at the bit under the supervision of one silver ranker or another. "We had little chance to control our own fates," Rufus said. His first words in days startled the others into stopping. "We came out here to get away from that," Rufus continued. "Yet she died under the command of Silvers."
"Because she followed me."
"Because of you?"
Gary growled, voice thundering.
"That's the biggest load of crap I've ever heard. You think she followed you around like a lost dog? Am I your pet cat? We came out here to control our own fates. You just said it yourself. She chose to be here, just like you. She knew the risks of this life, and she died protecting people like a hero."
Gary marched up to Rufus and shoved him hard, sending him stumbling back and falling over. Rufus pushed himself up on his elbows, only to be shoved down again by an enormous foot. Rufus looked up at Gary, finally shaken out of his blank expression.
"If I hear you try and take her sacrifice away ever again," Gary growled, "I'll beat you halfway to death, and then you and me will be done."
Gary lifted his foot off Rufus's chest and stormed off. Jason walked over and crouched next to Rufus, who lay on the hard ground with a shell-shocked expression. Jason looked down at Rufus, then over at Gary, marching on alone.
"We all lost her," Jason told Rufus. "You're not the only one who gets to mourn."
Jason stood up and followed after Gary. Amir emerged from the aperture into a camp that was in chaos. The original neat rows of tents had been added to in a haphazard fashion, poorly adapting to the influx of people from the expedition.
"What in the world are they doing out here?"
He marched over to the management tent, only to find that it was missing. He extended his senses, the low-level anger in his aura bringing out goosebumps in people all over the camp. He wasn't sufficiently familiar with Vincent Trenslow to pick his aura, and didn't sense Jason anywhere in the camp. He made his way to the closest bronze rank aura, terrifying its owner as he demanded the location of the management tent. It had been moved from its central location to an isolated rise outside the camp that had nice views and didn't smell of people. Amir stormed inside, where he found some bronze ranker with his feet up as he reclined eating grapes. The man shivered as he felt a gold rank aura pressing down on him, almost falling to the floor as he scrambled to his feet.
"Who are you?"
Amir asked.
"Cassius Fael, Lord Bahadir."
"I'm not an aristocrat, Fael. Where is Vincent Trenslow?"
"Who?"
"The person in charge of this camp."
"I'm in charge of this camp."
"Why? Where is the person that used to be in charge?"
"No idea. We saw him off."
"Saw him off?"
"We couldn't let him tell nobles what to do. He was just some common filth."
"Like me?"
Fael went white as milk.
"How did you end up in charge?"
Emir asked.
"My mother told me to do it,"
Fael said.
"Oh, dear gods. What about Asano?"
"Who?"
"Trenslow's assistant."
"The mouthy one? We got rid of him, too."
"Did Asano say anything about the five people whose tracking was lost?"
"Right, yes," Thale said. I found out he had people watching them. Can you believe it? The families they come from, and he had people spying. Obviously, I got rid of them and warned the families.
Emir looked at the idiot incredulously, taking a slow, calming breath.
Do you know why Asano didn't tell me about any of this?
He did try to go see you, but we stopped him. He was obviously just going to complain and toady, so we made sure he didn't bother you. A little gratitude would be appreciated.
Emir ran a hand over his face.
Suddenly, I see the flaw in putting all the competent people on one side of the aperture and the rest on the other.
Sir?
Fail. Where is Trenslow now?
I had to have him confined to one of the dormitory tents, Fail said. He kept coming in to make stupid suggestions. I'm the one in charge now.
Here's what's going to happen,
Emir said, keeping himself under control as his voice audibly teetered at the edge of breaking into a yell.
You are going to find Trenslow and tell him, along with anyone who objects, that I have personally placed him in charge of this camp. Then figure out how to stay out of my sight, because if I ever see you again, I might just slap you so hard it changes your religion. Do you understand what I've just told you?
I think so, sir. My family worships Vineyard, if that helps. He's subordinate to the god of revels.
Oh, dear gods. Look, just tell me where I can find him.
The god of revels?
Trenslow, you cretin!
Rufus trailed behind Gary and Jason at a distance for the rest of the day, the pair occasionally glancing back to make sure he was still there. Once darkness came, Jason and Gary made camp. They set out aura-suppressing tents that would shield them from the senses of unintelligent monsters and placed a warming stone that saved them making a fire. The arid air rapidly cooled once the sun went down, and while any adventurer could withstand it, they would rather not. Gary especially, as his fur had a natural ability to diffuse heat while offering little insulation. Sitting on blankets on either side of the cylindrical heatstone, they were eventually joined by Rufus. His formerly blank expression now looked tired and haunted. They sat in silence for a long time before Rufus unexpectedly spoke.
"Remember that little village in the eastern reaches?" he asked Gary.
Gary looked at Rufus in surprise.
"The one with the flour mill?"
Rufus nodded, and Gary burst out laughing.
"Am I missing something?" Jason asked.
"There was this flour mill," Gary said. "Farah wasn't always so accurate with her unruly volcano powers, and she blew up a flour mill. The explosion did kill the monster, though."
"What kind of storytelling is that?" Rufus asked Gary. "You jumped right to the end."
"If you want to tell it properly," Gary said, "then tell it."
"I will, then," Rufus said. "This was a few years ago, when Farah and I had just hit bronze. Gary had been bronze for a few years when we met him, but he'd been slacking off."
"I was focusing on my forge craft, not slacking off."
"So he claims," Rufus said.
"The three of us took this contract, way out in the eastern reaches. It was a long way, and there weren't a lot of takers. But it was a low magic zone, and we could go without supervision, so we accepted the contract.
I thought you told me coming out here was your first chance to take contracts without a silver ranker over your shoulder."
"Well, there was this one instance," Rufus said. "It didn't go very well."
"They made us go back and deliver a bunch of food," Gary said, "on account of having blown up their flour mill."
"What did I just say about jumping to the end?" Rufus asked. "So, we set out for the eastern reaches, and the mission seemed plagued from the start. One of the Heidels went lame in the middle of nowhere, and none of us were healers. That was when we found out that Heidels don't respond well to healing potions."
Chapter 113. You need to work on making enemies. The Cloud Palace was not only the largest magic construction in Greenstone, but it was also the most sophisticated. This was demonstrable in ways large and small, from its ability to take multiple forms to the amenities incorporated throughout the structure. In Belinda and Sophie's guest suite, there were several cooler cabinets, each with a front of translucent mist. Belinda went to the one specifically for non-alcoholic beverages and reached directly through the veil, her hand feeling the chill. She retrieved a frosty pitcher of fruit punch and took it back to the terrace table where she and Sophie had been spending their idle days.
"This is so strange," she said,
sitting down in a meltingly soft patio chair made of blue and white mist.
"Did you ever expect to experience something like this?"
"No," Sophie said, taking the pitcher and pouring out drinks into crystal tumblers. "It scares me."
"You're wondering that if it's so good now, how wrong will it go later?"
"I am. I don't know what game Asano is playing, or how he intends to use us."
"It can't be worse than handing us over to Silver, or that Magic Society guy," Belinda said. "Look around. The director of the Adventure Society doesn't dare come get us. If this is the company Asano is keeping, what does he care about Silver, or even the local Magic Society? What could he possibly need us for?"
"Lots of things, none of which are good for us."
"Jory thinks Asano is doing this to help us," Belinda said. "You don't seriously believe that?"
"I believe that he believes.
So does Clive."
After Asano and Bahadir had departed, Clive had periodically appeared to visit Belinda, the two spending hours going over the various tools and tricks she employed in her career as a professional thief. They also toured the Cloud Palace and its myriad wonders. The palace was enormous, with multiple wings in all directions, connected to a central building by cloud pathways. The palace was unaffected by floating on the exposed water, with neither wind nor wave causing so much as a shudder. There were dining rooms, ballrooms, bedrooms, bathrooms, ritual rooms, parlors, terraces, kitchens, studies, training halls, libraries, art galleries. It just went on and on. In the lowest levels, below the waterline, there were lounges with walls of translucent mist, allowing occupants to see out into the water. Very few places seemed out of bounds, with the major exception being Bahadir's personal suite. It occupied the top floors of the central building, but almost all the other areas were open to them. The other restricted areas were secure rooms containing various valuables. The two thieves naturally thought of robbing the place, but were not foolish enough to try. Experimentally, they went to the cloud path that led to the shore. None of the people Emiya left behind attempted to stop the two women, as they stood just inside the palace, looking out. The bridge to the shore was anchored directly in front of the Adventure Society reception building, beyond which were garden paths leading deeper into the campus.
"I really don't think they'll try to stop us leaving," Belinda said.
"They don't need to," Sophie said. "Do you really think we'd get out of the Adventure Society grounds without being snatched up?" Rufus held out his glass. "To Farah." Gary and Jason touched their glasses to his, and they drank. The trio was in an open-air bar in one of the wealthier parts of the city of Boko. It had been a day and a half since they arrived, and they had been exploring the city. It wasn't a port city like Greenstone, or as large. As such, the population wasn't as diverse, being made up almost entirely of humans. They were very dark-skinned, like the Ustai, but the cultures were clearly very different. The hairstyles in Boko weren't wild and crazy, and the clothes weren't a patchwork mess. The local fashion was loose and breathable, like that of Greenstone, but in more subdued colors. Earthy browns, yellows, and reds dominated, compared to the kaleidoscope of colors the Greenstone populace preferred. Gary and Rufus shared more stories about Farah, while Jason brought them up to speed on his activities in their absence.
You want to make this thief girl an adventurer? Rufus asked. What was her name again?
Sophie Wexler. She's a Celestine. No family ties in Greenstone, from what little I was able to get out of her.
It's a creative solution, Rufus said. At the very least, it would prevent her from being quietly handed off to Lamprey in some backroom political deal. The society would never allow that for a member.
Lamprey's fixation on her is the key, Jason said. It's the lever Arella is tugging on. If we can definitively remove Wexler from Lamprey's reach, that lever goes away. Her political value vanishes, and she goes back to being just some woman from Old City.
The problem is her fugitive status, Rufus said. Until that gets resolved, you won't be able to get her Adventure Society membership.
What if we did it here? Gary asked. She's not a fugitive here in Boko, and they have an Adventure Society branch.
I thought about that, Jason said. There's too much chance of Arella finding out and interfering. One communication to the branch director here, and everything comes unraveled.
Then what's the plan? Rufus asked.
The key is the service agreement between the Adventure Society and Greenstone, Jason said. The right to her indenture is clearly mine. So long as the Adventure Society legal advocate doesn't roll over, there won't be an issue. Which means we either need leverage on the advocate or leverage on Arella.
The thing with her father being a crime lord isn't enough?
Gary asked.
I very much doubt it, Jason said. Rising above her criminal past to become an anti-corruption crusader is a narrative she can use to her advantage. It does make it harder for her to make any blatantly corrupt moves, though.
You may not have to do anything, Rufus said. The leverage may provide itself.
Oh? Jason prompted.
The Adventure Society recognizes that politicking is a required part of administrating a branch, but society interests have to be protected above all else. We just lost a whole slew of adventurers, which means the Continental Council will be raining down in full force. There will be an inquiry that holds the Greenstone Adventure Society upside down and shakes it until all the goodies come out.
And Arella is the one responsible for the makeup of the expedition, Jason said, realization dawning. Everyone wanted in, so she let in every political rival who wanted to go along instead of building an effective team.
Still, the blame could fall in a lot of places. I'm guessing it depends on who does the blaming?
It will depend on who the Continental Council sends, Rufus said.
The expedition was a mess, Gary said. Surely it has to fall on Arella. We lost so many because there weren't enough strong people to shield the weak.
The glass in Rufus's hand shattered, his face full of quiet but hot burning fury.
Farrah died covering those people, he said. I'm done putting up with Greenstone's worthless adventurers. I think I'll pay Elspeth Arella a visit myself.
I would hold off unless you have a goal beyond yelling at her, Jason said. Don't muddy the waters unless muddy water is useful to you.
Danielle and Amir finally declared the expedition at an end. They withdrew all their people back through the aperture, along with everything they collected. Although the cost in blood was heavy, they succeeded in their goal of finding and stopping what disrupted the astral space. A network of astral magic nodes had affected the whole astral space. They hadn't figured out what it was for yet, but they didn't need to. They just needed to take it down. They did exactly that, packing away large portions in dimensional bags for study and destroying the rest. As people and supplies were loaded onto skimmers and sand barges, Amir and Danielle looked at an object, waiting to be packed away. It was a five-sided column, the height of a person, and covered in engravings, one of many waiting to be stowed away.
So, this is what was causing all the trouble, Amir said. How many are we talking?
Our people examined them, Danielle said. There are 15 different types, so we're taking 3 of each and destroying the rest. It's the Magic Society's problem now.
It is what they do, Amir said,
I think it's past time I added an astral magic specialist to my team.
The columns had been the physical medium of the astral magic. No one in the expedition could even tell if destabilization was the goal or a side effect. They would also be taking the remains of several construct creatures, plus one construct they had captured intact. Their purpose and origins would eventually be teased out by the Magic Society.
"What about Rufus and Asano?" Emiya asked. "Any word?"
"There was some kind of altercation," Danielle said. "Shortly after, Gary and Jason took Rufus out into the desert and didn't come back. According to Vincent Trenslow, they were heading for the city, so you should find them there."
The return to Greenstone was going to take two paths. The vast majority of the people and supplies would take the skimmers and barges they brought with them back overland, with Danielle in command. Emiya and his people would return the extra skimmers requisitioned from the city of Boko.
"Do me a favor when you head to the Adventure Society in Boko," Danielle asked Emiya. "See if the Ustai have been causing trouble since we turned them back out where they came from."
When he arrived in Boko, his first goal was to arrange the local Adventure Society branch to send periodic silver rank patrols into the astral space. Left alone, the astral space should eventually return to normal functioning, replenishing the drying oases. After that, he would return to Greenstone via portal ability. Many of the more prestigious members of the expedition petitioned to join him, but were refused outright. When the last of the gear was packed up, both groups left the aperture behind. Emiya and his people had the shorter journey, arriving at Boko within the day. He organized his people to return the requisitioned skimmers and see if they could find Rufus, Jason, and Gary. Emiya was on his way to the Adventure Society headquarters when something strange appeared in front of him. "You have received a voice chat request from Jason Asano. Accept. Yes, no."
"What?"
Hester was the member of Emiya's staff who had opened the portal to Boko and back. She was widely travelled, which was an advantage to anyone with such a power. Portal-type abilities had several limitations, starting with destination. They could only be opened to locations where the one with the power had been before. There were also limits to who could use it, based on rank. The only reason she was able to create a portal the gold rank Emiya could travel through was that her portal ability had reached gold rank, even though she hadn't. After Emiya reunited with Jason, Rufus, and Gary in Boko, they were all returned to Greenstone via portal, right next to the Cloud Palace. It was late in the afternoon, and Emiya led them inside, where a large meal was quickly arranged. Emiya's people went about their business after that, except for Constance. She joined Emiya, Jason, Gary, and Rufus on one of the many terraces the Cloud Palace had to offer. They took after-dinner drinks as they watched the sunset over the ocean. Jason let out a loud sigh. "I'm just now remembering the crisis I was dealing with before the other crisis," he said. "I miss the Essence and Awakening Stone auction. Is that mysterious thing of yours still coming up, Emiya?"
"I'm going to push it back," Emiya said. "I was intending to rely on the Greenstone's iron rankers, but that clearly isn't viable. The entire adventure community here will be reeling from the results of this expedition. Even if that weren't the case, the standards here are lower than I feared. A few standouts aside, the general skill level is woeful. I'm going to put out an open contract and ship more capable people in."
"You'll have some competition, Jason,"
Gary said.
"Competition for what?"
Jason asked.
"Something that will, for the moment, remain unrevealed," Emiya said. "Suffice to say, there is a place that only Iron Rankers can go, in which there is a thing Iron Rankers cannot use. Whoever brings that thing to me shall receive glorious prizes."
"And this place will have essences and awakening stones?"
Jason asked.
"If the conditions are what we believe, then yes."
"Still," Jason said, "if you're moving it back, I'm going to need another source of essences."
"You still want to make this thief girl an adventurer?" Emiya asked.
"That,
or send her so far from here it's not worth anyone looking. Given how hard it would be to get her into the Adventure Society, that's the direction I was leaning. That may change, depending on how much trouble Elspeth Arella is in.
A lot, Emir said. The Society doesn't like to interfere with its branch directors, but losing all those adventurers will be more than they're willing to tolerate. Danielle Geller told me that she lodged a protest about the makeup of the expedition before it even left. That will make things all the worse for Arella. I will be astounded if she keeps her position.
Then I should act quickly, Jason said. If she has to walk the line, suddenly the rules people have been stomping over have some teeth. If I can lock in the indenture, that resolves Wexler being a fugitive, and if I can then make her an adventurer, she'll have the Society's protection.
I've never heard of anyone getting their indentured servant into the Adventure Society, Constance said. The Society's protection of its members would eliminate almost all control over them.
Jason has been making crazy choices to rescue people since literally the day we met, Gary said. You get used to him.
No, you don't, Rufus said. Jason, you need to work on making enemies of your own rank. You have the directors of the Adventure Society and the Magic Society after you now.
Yeah,
Jason said.
But how amazing will it be when I win?
This is the end of He Who Fights with Monsters, a Podium audio production. If you enjoyed this audiobook, we would love for you to rate and review it. For more heroic adventures, check us out at podiumaudio.com and sign up for our newsletter. We promise we won't spam you. Also, consider joining our community of listeners, fans, and trolls on social media. We're active on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and Reddit. We'd love to connect. You have been listening to He Who Fights with Monsters, Book 1 of He Who Fights with Monsters, produced by Emily Durr, written by Shirtaloon, performed by Heath Miller. Text copyright 2021 by Shirtaloon. Production copyright 2021 by Podium Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.